Welcome. We're so glad to have you with us, David. Would you please introduce yourself and a bit about your business to my audience before we launch into the interview?
Sure, Carol. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak about Playa Viva. We call Playa Viva a sustainable boutique hotel. We use the word sustainable because a lot of people don't know the word regenerative yet, although Playa Viva is part of what we call the Regenerative Resorts, which is a group of hotels that we're now working on forming of other like-minded eco-luxury products, properties, hotels that are trying to cater to some of the same values that we are. The motto that we have is where your vacation meets your values. And many of these values are those shared by your listeners, folks who want to make less of a footprint, contribute back to the local economies, and have much more of an experiential travel vacation. But Playa Viva is, as I said, a sustainable boutique hotel located near Zihuatanejo, Mexico, which is on the Pacific coast. We have 200 acres of land, of that about 11 acres of organically certified farm. So it's not just a hotel, but it's a working farm. And we're also regenerating the landscape around us, which includes a turtle sanctuary, estuary, mangrove, and a coastal forest that we're regenerating about almost a mile of beachfront, and also an archaeological site. So Playa Viva is hopefully a beautiful place that many of the folks that are listening to this will want to come and visit.
Oh, I think they will. And people will understand just from that introduction why there were the Regenerative Business Prize. You were an honoree for the Communing Stream, which was about really reconnecting people with something larger than themselves. I'm wondering if you could tell us just a little bit about how this idea came into your life. And I know it grew and changed over time, but knowing how ideas get seeded, I think, is something people are always curious about. Could you give us just a short bit of that story?
Sure. You know, I haven't been a hoteler for very long. We started out by having a small little property north of where Playa Viva is, a little bed and breakfast. We built it green back in 2000, before we even heard of the Green Build movement. My wife went off to Green Build conference and met with a bunch of different people, including the folks from Regenesis, who came back. Sandra came back, my wife came back and said, you know, I met the people that I want to help us work on this project because I love the way they think. And that's when I had a conversation with Bill Reed. And, you know, Bill was really telling me about the whole regenerative concept, about working in much more of a whole systems thinking way. And, you know, what we can do to understand our effect on the place. And, you know, when I first heard Bill's story, I was like, you know, Bill, excuse my French here, bullshit. You know, anytime we as humans are building, we're degrading. And Bill said, you know, not necessarily, you know, assuming that 99% of the case, the humans have touched and degraded that land in some form or fashion. If you understand the history of place and how that location got to be the way it is, then you can understand your role in the stewardship of that place in the blink of the eye in which we're on that land and the relative time of the land. And yeah, I said, okay, I'll buy that. That works for me. And so that's when we embarked on this whole process of doing a history of place study and really understanding Playa Viva, not just as the 200 acres of land that were marked by, you know, the border and perimeter of it, but really understanding its place in the overall community that was nearby, the watershed that it was part of, which was the watershed of the Huluchuca River, which is a small little watershed, and where it fit kind of in this history from not just a geological time, but from an archaeological time to kind of most recent history of the agriculture that had been done on this land, which we had taken over, which was a coconut grove and a mango grove, and what its potential was and what our role was in that potential.
You know, as I I've never been there, and I will be. I am determined to come be there. But I have heard Regenesis and folks who have come there with Pamela and Bob talk about their experience. And one of the things they talk about most, which I'd love for you to give us a few stories about, is how you improve the economy by changing what was a crumbling kind of operation, which, of course, you could have tried to give people a bunch of jobs and stuff and then claimed victory. But you took on a very different way of helping a community become more vital and economically strong. Could you give us a handful of stories, if that's helpful, that talk sure. about how that played out?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, I had done some background work in social impact and environmental impact. And in social impact, you know, there was always a question of, you know, what's social impact investing? Is it just creating more jobs? And yeah, I mean, if that's just the criteria, then Walmart is the greatest social impact company there is because they create the most jobs. No, it's not just about jobs and quality jobs, but yes, it's how it really addresses the fabric of the community. When we did our history of place, one of the things that we did was we interviewed some of the elders, some of the town elders. And a couple of things that we got back from it. One was the abundance that once marked that area. The other thing that we got back from them was that the area used to be alive and vibrant and living from a people standpoint, but they felt that their community was dying, that all the young people were moving to El Norte, all the young people were moving to Mexico City or Tijuana because there was no opportunity. There was nothing there. And so we, you know, I think one of the things I'm so proud of is that the community is now vibrant. It's not a dying community anymore. It's a community that is becoming a center to attract people and to attract people who are interested in creating change, making a difference, and doing something positive. So I think that was one of the core things that touched me in this process is hearing the elders talk about how they saw this community dying and how kind of Playa Viva coming in completely has transformed the vibrancy of the community.
So give us a few of those stories, because I know that there were people who were making a living
yes.
from things that were pretty destructive. And most people would have said, well, you know, you're going to be fighting an uphill battle. But you created a series of processes and things that led to very different kind of work,
sure.
different kind of business. Give us a couple of those stories.
Sure. I think you look at what people traditionally make a living from in that area, and a lot of it is agriculture. A lot of it is ranching. Something special in the area would be the salt. Then obviously the beaches and what happens in the beaches. So, you know, first of all, let's look at agriculture. Obviously, slash and burn agriculture, using pesticides, they were definitely polluting and destroying their landscape. And I think Playa Viva, with this 11-acre organic farm, is becoming a demonstration plot for how to farm organically and sustainably. One of the things that we're doing with that is we've connected with companies in the United States. One of them was through a volunteer who came and stayed at Playa Viva. She later got a job with a company in the United States called 18 Rabbits, which makes organic granolas and granola bars. And so when they were looking to buy direct, Emma said, hey, why don't we go back to Playa Viva? That community can make some of the items that are in some of our bars, like sesame seeds and pumpkin seeds and dried mangoes and other things like that. So they brought their board down, met with us, met with the community, and saw that, you know, it was even transformational for them because they saw it wasn't about just buying direct and lowering your price. It was about ecosystem development. It was going into an area that wasn't already creating these products and going to farmers and saying, if you guys will grow organic, we will buy from you and support you. So, you know, that's what happened when we went to farmers first and started to train them to grow organic. They were like, great, but who's going to buy this stuff? You know, we'll just grow it the normal way. But now it's not only just teaching them how to grow organic, but providing them with a market for their products and a good price for their products. So, So that was one thing, was the agriculture part. The other thing that we've seen is take the salt. They have this wonderful salt that they've been making for centuries. I mean, in the history of place work, we saw that the salt was the tribute to the Aztec kings. But what they were doing was, is the traditional way of making it was to make what they call eras, which stands for wishes, which are these little kind of 2 by 2 meter ponds that they would then use calcium and clay and a pumice stone and make these beautiful little swimming pools for drying up the kind of salt brine from the estuaries, which would fill annually. And but what happened was, is doing that work and making the investment in the calcium and doing it the traditional way, it was easier to just use plastic bags, plastic liners. Mm-hmm. And so they would just, instead of using the calcium and the pumice stone, they would just line it with black plastic. Well, you can imagine, you know, what it's like, you know, if you're not supposed to drink water out of a plastic cup or put plastic in a microwave, imagine, you know, salt sitting in the sun for days, just drying in this black plastic. It's awful for you. But by going in and working with folks, not trying to tell people who were doing the plastic that they were bad, but by putting a premium price and guaranteeing purchases of the what we call traditional salt, that it really provided an economic incentive for people to go back to the traditional salt while we were providing education about kind of the dioxins and the negative effects of using the plastic. Plus, they also left the plastic lying around after each season, which created more pollutants. So, I mean, those are just two stories. I mean, there are other ones, such as just the work in doing the mangrove restoration, or even working with the turtle sanctuary.
We might do a little bit about the mango one, because the other question I wanted to ask you, you were coming in through the window of economic and community development. You have really paid attention because of the storying of that place and going back and looking at its history. You have looked at species which were stripped out in animal and plant, and you've paid attention to the regeneration of, you know, kind of the membrane of that area. Can you talk a bit about what you've done that is regenerating the marsh?
Well, I mean, what we did is we really looked at the 200 acres we had and then divided it into several zones. We had the coastal zone, which was right along the beach and the dunes. We had a area which was made up of mangrove and estuary. Then we had, or the wetlands, and then we had another area that kind of went up the hill and made more of a kind of coastal forest area. And what we really found was that through, again, slash and burn agriculture, that previous landowners had come in and just destroyed the biodiversity that was there and all the habitat for a lot of the animals. Now, it hadn't been worked probably in about 10 or 15 years since we bought it, because it was in probate. And the family, again, through the dying community, none of the children of the mom who had it wanted to work the land and had left and gone away. And so we brought in, you know, the permaculture team, biologists, many different experts to then look at what was there, and then also look at other areas around the beach or up and down the coast to see if there were any areas that hadn't been disturbed. And we had found plenty of a few areas where we could get seed stock for trees that grew in this coastal forest. And so we developed a nursery with 10,000 trees. About half of them were native trees of the area. The other half were trees that we were going to use in the orchard for citruses and for food stock for the hotel, and transplanted and regenerated this coastal forest. The other part was working in the estuary with a mangrove. So there was a small area on a very tip of the property where the mangrove had not been destroyed, and we were able to use that as a starting point to then dredge areas that had been mangrove and slowly but surely bring back 4 different types of mangrove into that area that were native to that area. And it was interesting, as we did it, you know, we kind of planted them by hand and eventually found that the mangrove would find their natural point. Some like to be right on the water, some like to be on the edge of the water, some like to be higher up on the waterline as we brought them back. And then slowly but surely we would regenerate a piece, and then we would wait a year, and then we would dredge a little bit more, and then we would regenerate a little piece and then dredge a little more. So that's been our project. And then, you know, obviously the mangrove serve as the inland counterpart of coral reef, which provides area for the fish to regenerate. And so this is something where, you know, the community had been talking about how the biodiversity, the amount, the abundance that was once there is gone, and they didn't realize that the reason it was gone was because they were cutting down and destroying the mangrove. Oh. So this is part of the education role. So it's not just, you know, coming in and doing it, but it's coming in and showing folks how we're doing it, inspiring them to do it where their land touches the estuary, talking about the education about what the mangrove means, and then seeing the effects as they start to see fish stock regrow, it really hits home with them.
I noticed that one of the ideas.
Oh, well, the other one is just working on the beach zone with the turtle sanctuary.
Right.
The turtles is a species that had been endangered and is seen as an aphrodisiac in Mexico, and so, you know, the Mexican government has come in and banned the kind of poaching of turtles, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen, whether it's, you know, turtle soup or turtle eggs. And we were able to work with the folks in the local community who once were poachers to become conservationists. It's interesting how, you know, hunters become sometimes the best conservationists, as happened in this case. And so we've worked in helping to put together a local NGO with 14 local volunteers who work in shifts of 2, 7 days a week, go out with a 4x4 and patrol the beaches, see where the turtles come up, get to the turtle eggs before the poachers do and before the predators, because there are, you know, dogs and coatis and raccoons and other animals that come in and dig up the nest. And bring them back to a sanctuary, a sheltered area, a fenced-in area, transplant those turtle eggs. And then when they hatch, one of the things that we do is we work with the tourists who are staying at the hotel to work with the volunteers in releasing the baby turtles. And, you know, the tourists obviously love that. The volunteers then see the value of this, you know, of the biology that is in their area, of the biodiversity that's in the area, which is something that they once didn't give it value, or the value was really to consume it. Now they see the value in conserving it. And the guests are obviously encouraged at that point to provide a donation, which then goes to the turtle sanctuary to cover for the 4x4 for them to patrol the beach, the gasoline, the other resources that they need, and to give them, they get a food stipend that goes to all the volunteers. Interestingly enough, one of the volunteers passed away while we've been working with them, and the volunteers voted to give a food stipend to the widow to continue giving it to the widow over time.
Wow, that's such a moving story. One of the things we talk about with regeneration is the idea of being nodal about what you do rather than shotgun, do everything, finding what are the key places to enter. And certainly you talked about one of them really was actually understanding the criticality of an estuary. And it's giving you a lot of information because the mangroves are there, many different kinds of flora and fauna. And if you can intervene there, you get a big shift. A second one, which I want to get you to talk about a little more, is shifting the mind of the people who live there because they couldn't see what they've done. And you had an intention to create what I've seen called the culture of co-evolution with a place. And you gave us a hint at how you did that, but getting people really connected deeply back with their place and being educated in a way to understand how they're a partner with it has been a really core aim of your work. Could you go a little deeper on how you go about doing that? So, you know, how in the world do you get people from living the way they were and not seeing their impact to understanding and wanting to be a deep part of it?
Sure. It's an interesting question because in many ways, these folks lived in harmony with the land for a very long time. And it hasn't been until recently that they stopped living in harmony with the land when, kind of, for the lack of a better term, certain Western culture has shifted them. And the issue is kind of acknowledging what those shifts are and then kind of shifting back to, as we hear them sometimes say, is this is the way we used to do it, and find value in the way they used to do it. So, you know, how do we work with things like that? I think a lot of it is something that you touched upon earlier, which is, you know, finding honor in who they are and them and their history. And another one is connectivity. One of our interns came as a volunteer to do a project on culinary tourism. And she was going from home to home to cook with some of the women. And one of them said, hey, you know, you should come to my cousins. They live up the Sierra and cook with them. And after she went up the Sierra and cooked with them, she came back and was like, oh my God, David, you have to go up there. I mean, this was going to be like your most popular excursion. And we went up to the top of the Sierra, about an hour up the Sierra by 4x4, and met the Gutierrez family, which is a family that lives off the grid there. And they have, you know, four different types of cane for cane sugar and you know, like eight different types of banana. And, you know, all it is the little Garden of Eden up there. It's wonderful and beautiful. And they pretty much live off of what they grow from the land. And so, you know, one of the things that was also great about that, not just as a kind of for tourism aspect, but it connected Playa Viva, which was at the base of the estuary, at the base of the, or the estuary, at the base of the watershed, all the way up to the top of the watershed. And it made that connection for us and made the connection for kind of everyone around us that it's not just about what happens, again, on the 200 acres or in the community around us, but all the way up the watershed, so that, you know, as we were going up there and coming down, everything that happened within that watershed was important. So, you know, from the waste, the way the agricultural pesticides were washing into the system and affecting it. There were so many things that were happening throughout the entire watershed that began to affect this community, and they began to see that they were connected. I think I said earlier, one is a certain honor for who they are and the systems that they had, then helping them connect the entire system that they were part of. And so the way they used to do it to the entire system. And then I think the other thing that's interesting is when people come in from the outside, tourists, and then tourists participate in that entire process, that it provides them with pride around all of those things. So it provides pride in place and pride in their cultural heritage. And it's everything from, you know, using old wattle and daub construction methods that they would use, using some of the old agricultural techniques that were pre-slash and burn, crop combinations, etc. Those are some of the things that I think resonate with me related to that. There's probably something that I'm forgetting right off that I should be addressing related to this topic.
One of the things that I'm curious about that follows from this is you had an intention, and then at Greenbuild, you know, you discovered a resource, but you had to grow and learn. You and your wife had to grow and learn. Can you talk just a little bit about your own path? And because what I want people to get is how this is really a different paradigm. This is not just sustainability. I mean, it literally is connecting to something as a whole. How do you get your mind there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting because my wife and I have somewhat of a background in the environmental side of things. My mother-in-law is a big environmentalist in Mexico and had saved a park in Acapulco from being built and stopped a dam from being built and also stopped a GMO corn from coming into Mexico. But many of those were kind of, you know, piecemeal projects around the importance of just that ecological piece. And I think in kind of moving from green to even sustainable to regenerative, they are kind of exponential pops and growths that you need to make. And I think part of some of the work that we did, not just in our background in the environment, is also some of the work that we were doing in social impact, was seeing how those pieces play together, but there's even more pieces that play together to that, is the sense of whole systems thinking. Again, history of place, that how things move in a continuum and the role that you can play in the evolution of that place. And I think it's looking at flows as well. So really starting to think about all the energy flows, water, energy itself, people flows, the flow of the biodiversity in that zone. One thing I just remembered related to biodiversity in the zone is we were really happy that we got a white-tailed deer back on the property. And I just got a report from our head of permaculture that they spotted the deer and that the deer is pregnant.
Oh, so, that's so exciting.
but back to us and the evolution. Yes, it definitely has. And I think part of that evolution too is, even Playa Viva has been, we didn't develop this master plan and just boom, build it all at once in one single shot. We built it a little bit and then we really wanted to see, okay, what is the carrying capacity of the land? How much water can we get from the land and not be extractive? And then, grow that over time. So that's been, I think, a real interesting part, is that we built and we watched and we sat back and we learned, and then we built more and we sat back and we watched and we learned. And it's been this kind of interactive process with the landscape and with the community. It's definitely been interesting to see how the employees working at the hotel have begun to adopt and adapt some of the processes that they've learned at the hotel with us, and then have taken them home, and then that they kind of echo throughout the community and, up the watershed. So, it's something that takes a lot of patience. I think the other thing too is, in building, really getting a sense for the land and what needs to be where. There's so much that's built, especially from an architectural standpoint, where the architect is just, even if they come and walk the land, they go back to their office and they draw it on a blank piece of paper, and then they give it to you to go into location. And, I just wanted to drag the architect out there and have him just live there for a year to really grok and understand the place before he goes back or she goes back to kind of the drawing board to put together what the next phase is. So that's the advantage we have, is we're there. And so we can work hand in hand with them in taking their ideas and their concepts with what the land is telling us.
So how has this changed you as persons? Are you a different person than before you even began Playa Viva? And can you describe any of that?
Yeah. That's a very good question. How's kind of the whole regenerative process changed me?
Yeah, generated.
It's interesting. My wife and I did a project in Calakmul where that was our first big environmental project. It was called Rainforest to Reef, and it through a conservation easement program helped save over 250,000 acres of land through this conservation easement. for jaguar habitat. And in doing that particular project, that was kind of one of the first big changes for me. It made me realize how important what I consumed was as important as what I conserved. When we started working with Playa Viva, I think what really affected me was I participated in this conference called Opportunity Collaboration, and it has this thing called the colloquiums, in which we do these readings and then we talk together as a group. It's like a homeroom in a conference. And one of the readings is this Korean proverb. And to make it short, it basically states the king sends his prince to meet with his sensei, who's going to teach him everything he needs to know about ruling and governing. And the prince gets there and the sensei says, okay, go out and gather as much firewood and we'll set up a fire here by the river. So the prince goes out and he gathers a huge amount of fire of wood because he wants to make a huge fire to learn all these lessons. And so they make this huge bonfire and they sit down and the sensei sits there and doesn't say a thing. And the prince is waiting and waiting and the fire burns by the river and it's burning and burning and burning all night long and it burns all the way to the ground. There's nothing left. And the sensei doesn't say a thing. And finally, the prince is just had enough. He's like, you know, sensei, please, you know, give me some wisdom. He says, well, you know, haven't you learned what you need to learn? And the prince says, no. And the sensei says, you know, you went out and you got all this firewood and you built this huge bonfire and the bonfire is gone. It's only down to embers. But when we sat down, that river was flowing and that river flowed while that bonfire burned and it's still burning. It's still flowing and it's going to flow after we're gone. And the lesson to me really is that that lesson is what reflected to me and how being a part of Playa Viva and the regeneration changed me. It really made me realize so many projects come in and they try to be fire. They collect all this firewood, they come in and they just try to make it just burn bright, but it's, after a while, it's gone. But the effect that we're making it is more like the river. And that's really what I tell our staff is, you know, how is what we're doing more like the water than like the fire? Because that's the change that the whole regenerative process has done for me. It's really made me understand kind of the deeper nature of place, of time, and really kind of that whole systems component. It's not just the fire, it's the water.
Wow. That's really a beautiful story, David. Well, it's a very moving story and metaphors often help us, right? We can remember, I am burning me and everybody out, or am I being a part of a river where you step in the river and you become a part of it?
Well, I think by your honoring the things that people are doing, you know, all these little drops of water, all those drops bead together and form, you know, more power. So that's where I think you are definitely part of water. And thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. And I am so grateful to you taking the time to do this and to, we all feel very grateful. The judges, as they read the nomination, were all very moved and you instantly were moved to the head of the pack. And we all can hear that story now. And I'm sure there are people who will want to know more. Would you tell us how they can find you? What your website, if people have questions, what's the best way to follow up on that? If they want to make a reservation, how would they do that?
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. Yes. It is often difficult that, you know, you're just a hotel, but you're not just a hotel. But yes, it's important that people come and that they stay with us and they participate in what happens in the community. The best way to get in touch with us is through our website, which is the obvious playaviva.com. And if you send us an email at info@playaviva.com, somebody will get back to you as well.
David Leventhal, I love what you are up to, what you and Sandra are up to. I think it's quite amazing. And I really look forward to spending some time there myself as soon as possible.
We'd love to have you, Carol. Thank you very much.